Welcome back to An Alien in Hollywood, the life and times of the godfather of Hollywood science fiction, Ron Shusett. I'm here with my partner, Robin Maxwell, and we're moving on to Ron's second blockbuster film released in 1990, Total Recall, a movie that predates Terminator and made Arnold Schwarzenegger into the world's biggest action hero. Alien had changed everything, not just in the sci-fi horror genre. It raised the bar in quality special effects, excellence in storytelling, and sheer cinematic terror. And of course, it made Sigourney Weaver an overnight sensation.
And the members of the genius team that brought us Alien were not exactly resting on their laurels. Ridley Scott went on to become one of the most famous and prolific director-producers in history. He had Blade Runner, Thelma and Louise, Gladiator, The Martian, to name a tiny fraction of his films and television shows. If you remember from the very first episode, Ron and Dan O'Bannon, in the first days after they'd met and were working on Alien, while Dan was still living in a garret in L.A., they were already scheming to take the Philip K. Dick short story that Ron had recently optioned for $1,000, a story called We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, and turn it into their next movie. But even with the incredible success of Alien, their follow-up was going to be a very hard nut to crack, mostly because they knew the budget was going to be huge. They just never imagined how huge.
But also, now that Ron had experienced a behind-the-scenes scenario where he had a vision for a film long before it had found a studio, a distributor, a director, or a star, and despite resistance and power tripping and outright sabotage, his most cherished ideas had always managed to win over the director and cast, and usually turned out to be right.
You know, Harry, in the earlier episodes, I was struck by how many creative choices were disputed, where Ron had to fight for his vision against Ridley, against other writers, or even the studio. And it turned out, as he said so many times, I was right and they were wrong. And it might have sounded pompous or obnoxious, except that it was never actually about ego. It was just him, at a time when he had little or no experience to back him up, listening to his deepest instincts and having the courage to fight to the death for his way. If you listen closely, he was always terrified that he'd be wrong and have to suffer shame and humiliation for his mistake. And there's always this astonishment in his voice that he'd won the point and ultimately triumph. And not because he'd won, but because winning had made it a better movie.
So that was the backstory and attitude going into battle for Total Recall. Let's listen in.
You bought the rights to Phil Dick's story that became Total Recall for $1,000 way back, even before you got involved with Alien. What made you think it would be a great movie? And you knew even then it was going to be hugely expensive at a time when the conventional wisdom, you know, in Hollywood was making things as cheap as possible. How did you think you were going to get it made? And tell us the story about buying the rights at that time.
Okay, I used to read, I don't know what you call them, magazines that really weren't major works that you bought the rights to make a movie out of.
Pulp magazines?
Yes. I grew up from the time I was 13 or 14 or 15. I would buy like Amazing Stories and Galaxy and these little paperback pulp magazines before, when I was still, just starting high school. And I knew I wanted to do movies or plays. I was interested in both. But sparked my imagination was pulp stories. And I read them all, and there's some of those writers were very good, but they never made the leap to have their works bought for major projects. And one of them was Phil Dick. He had a following among pulp magazines, but his stories had the same, nobody wanted to buy any, even though he was writing great stories for several years before we got Total Recall made, nobody was interested in buying the rights to them and making them into a movie because they had the same general flaw that all studios felt was it wasn't a plentiful source, a bountiful source, because they were all the same tone. which they combined incredible fast-paced thrills every second with, this is why they didn't think it would lend itself to making movies out, with very complex plot twists that were hard to follow. And they thought the audience that loves those kind of stories, if it's sci-fi, they said they will be annoyed if you got all this nonstop action. And those that like nonstop action would say, it's too complicated. I can't follow all this stuff. They don't want all those complexities. So they felt there was two different audiences. You couldn't get either one of them with Phil Dick type of material. Everything he wrote was like that. And that was rare to have a combination of very challenging intellectual concepts with bam, 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 bam constantly, like Star Wars. Nobody wanted to buy any of his material and try and make it into a movie. Plus, it cost a lot because it would be anywhere, you know, in the future and other planets. And so the wisdom was that these things would never work as a major movie, even though they were very good. And other writers would start like that and they would go on to sell their stuff and make movies out of them. And I was in love with it just because I was 15 years old and I didn't think about the practicalities like that. I just knew I loved those kind of stories. Mm-hmm. And I was, at the same time, I was very early, I knew I wanted to be a producer and a writer. Well, first at plays, which I didn't. I knew I'd eventually want to go into movies because everybody, that was the most popular. What was the most thrilling? Make a big movie. That's what captivates most of you more than theater. That was before Alien. So, of course, it would be impossible. When I bought Total Recall, it would be impossible for me to get it made. It was so huge. And no, I'd never sold a script and never made a movie. But it was so cheap. On the other hand, nobody wanted it. So when I contacted his agent, not him, they were happy that somebody wanted to buy one of his stories, even though they knew I had no credibility and couldn't get it made. But nobody else was interested. So it was a $1,000 option. And then if I got the movie made, it would be $9,000 more, meaning the underlying rights would cost me $10,000. Usually, you know, and then before you make a movie, you buy the rights for you to go to a studio, and the studio plays all the rest. Well, it was a $20 million movie, and the rights I bought for was $1,000 up front, and another $9,000 if I ever got the $20 million to make the movie. And Linda and I were living like in two bedrooms in Hollywood, you know. It seemed absurd, really. But, of course, Dan and I, we got Alien completed, the script for it. Mm-hmm. But at that time, I had the rights to Total Recall, but it was almost impossible to make it because first with Alien, yeah, I had more credibility, but that cost nowhere near as expensive. But it wasn't at the time Total Recall got made, it was the most expensive movie in history. We didn't know it then. It was like $72 million, and no movie had ever cost more than $60 million. It wasn't this open sesame that when Alien even got made and became a huge hit, it was like 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years for me to get Total Recall made, because the only way they would make it, even with my success of Alien, was I had to have a huge star, you know, Robert Redford, I don't know, Brad Pitt, and a huge A-level director, Spielberg, Ridley Scott, after he did Alien, became one of those. Paul Verhoeven was a world-class director, had many hits for 10 years. But he was foreign director. He had made until he made RoboCop, and then he was a giant, and he ended up being the director. Before he did RoboCop, I tried to get him because I loved his foreign films like Soldier of Orange and other things he had written that were quality material. But his agent said, no, he hates science fiction. And that was before he made any American movies, because I loved his movies I'd seen from Cannes Film Festival and became so successful. And he said, no, science fiction's a joke to him. That was 8 years before he became the director of Total Recall. What changed everything ultimately was 8 years later, or 7 years later, he did his first American movie, and it was RoboCop, one of the great all-time science fiction breakthrough mm-hmm. movies. And then he immediately, he loved science fiction by that time, but I didn't know, you know, I knew he had done that, but I didn't know if it changed his mind about me going to science fiction. But the only way I got him was when I got Arnold got him in one phone call.
Can you back up just a little,
sure.
So that we get the kind of chronology of, so you had the rights.
Yes, I had the rights.
Where was the first place you went? Was it a producer, a director, a studio?
It was a studio. It was Disney, because I knew they had so much incredible wealth and power. And even though they hadn't had later revivals, like they became much bigger, Toy Story and all the Pixar, before they owned Pixar. So they weren't that big into science fiction. I went to them because it seemed like one of the few companies that was so powerful and could, you know, merchandise it, sell the merchandise and create a franchise and everything. So it was a natural, but I went to them and they liked it, but we had incredible disagreements on what the script would be. They liked the story and the concept, and they paid me a lot of money because I had Alien under my belt then when I went to Disney. They paid me a lot, and then I said, okay, my condition that I do this development with you is if I hate what you want to do with it, and I know the studio has full control, mm-hmm. I can pay back what you paid me and get my script back. You can't force me to do it or hire somebody else. If I'm not happy with what we're going to do, I want to repay you and get back the property. And they said, okay, but people never would do that. They didn't have the guts to say, well, you're ruining it. Here's your money back. I want the script back. There's a lot of money they paid me.
Was Dan O'Bannon involved at that point? Had he written the script with you?
Yeah, he wrote the script with me. We did Alien, and before Alien was released, we started writing Total Recall. And we finished it about a year after Alien came out. So then we both had a big credibility. Like, I really could in a company like Disney. They'd say, well, sure, we're receptive. And so they went into development. We had no script. We were working on a script, but we hadn't finished it. We had a first draft, and both of our reputations were huge. And so they entered into a deal with me, and then they started telling me how they want to change the script. I said, no, I don't want to do any of these things. And they said, well, we got to do it or we're going to do it without you. And I said, well, no, here's your money back. I want my script back. And they were shocked. I don't know, it was $100,000. And so as my agent at the time said, you not only own, he said, well, there's interest you owe us for 2 or 3 years there. I said, okay, fine. Here's the interest. And my agent said, you not only gave them their money back, but you threw them a tip. And they were shocked. What is this guy? He's crazy. How is he never going to get this made? And yet he gives it back to us.
Do you remember what some of the changes were that Disney wanted that you hated?
They were so massive. They were horrible. They just really wanted a different script that had, because the hard thing is, remember, there was no real foundation. It was only a first act, and you had only a short story. For example, you need a whole second act and a whole third act, and neither Disney or I knew what that was going to be. We were working on that. The thing that's interesting to gauge that is the final movie, Phil Dick's story only went up to page 40 on the script we actually got made. Everything after page 40, we had to invent out of a whole cloth, both this, not only the third act, but the second act. There was no second act. So, of course, nobody really knew at that time what the movie was going to be. It had a terrific catapult for a concept, and it was very, very hard to finish because it was so inventive. Phil Dick, most of his movies that got made after Total Recall, he started making his stories. It was a big hit, but almost all of them failed because he painted you into a corner. He was so brilliant conceptually as a setup that you could never equal him in the second and third act because he wrote all short stories, almost no novels. That's why all of the movies made after Total Recall, after Blade Runner, I guess it was, they failed because they could never live up to the brilliance of the concept. The second act was never as good, and the third act was even worse.
When you were with Disney, is that when you came up with second and third acts, or you still didn't have them when you left them?
I think I had most of it. I think I had most of the direction I wanted to go in. They said, no, we don't want to go in this direction. And they wanted to go in some more very mere stereotype, just a pulse-pounding thriller, and it didn't matter if the story worked or not. It was just action and special effects. That's all we need. Never mind the story. It's toy's too complicated. Don't try and make the story work. That's the worst mistake studios all make when they try to make these big action movies. They think that characters in the story don't matter at all, and nothing you can see will awe you when there have been so many amazing special effects. You can't thrill the audience any more than that, because you can never do anything more amazing that you've seen in other movies. So therefore, it goes back to the basics, which is ironic. It has to be like the old days when they didn't have $100 million movies. Mm-hmm. The best years of our lives, they had great characters and great story. The studios, but they had a sort of a repertoire because they were developing people. But when people are on their own, you weren't developing as a writer. Where the studios used to develop, they'd sign you a 7-year contract and you got better as a writer and a director and producer. But when the studio system died, people were doing their own and the studios couldn't get the stories right anymore. 70% of movies started to become failures where in the earlier days, and the height of the glory of the stories, 70% were hits. And that evaporated to 70% of movies made were failures because they didn't care about the most basic thing that you needed. Great characters and a great story.
Were there any directors attached while it was still at Disney?
No, I think that they couldn't get a director because they were arguing with me. I would keep shooting them down. And they didn't want to just go into this argument, and they never thought I'd have the guts to say, well, forget it, I'm taking it back, because they thought eventually they'll just force me to do it the way they wanted to do it. And so this went on for about a year, or maybe 18 months. And finally, I saw there was no hope they would care about story or characters at all, like the common mistakes that studios make when they make big action movies, and big, even big budget sci-fi. They would never care about it. And the thing that worked a lot was overseas, you could have a big hit without a good script because it's all visual. So even they didn't follow the story or the character, but they would make a lot of money overseas, even if they didn't make money in America. So encourage studios to get into that folly of, well, it doesn't matter what the story and the characters are. Just a lot of bad special effects and action. That's all we care about. And so I realized they were never going to care about being a good movie. Their definition of a good movie was throw as much action and special effects as you can, and it'll do money in Europe, and maybe it'll be good here, and maybe it won't. It won't matter.
So what happened once you left Disney? Where'd you go now? What was the next step?
I went to Dino De Laurentiis because he was famous for making huge movies. A lot of them were disasters. But he also started Vittorio De Sica, Fellini, Bergman. He had a way of saying, okay, these guys are geniuses, so I'll have hits them because I'll let them do whatever they want and I'll finance it. And that was guts. Most people didn't have that kind of guts. He did, but he had horrible instincts too that would ruin a lot of things if you let him have too much to say about it, unless you were a genius like Bergman or Vittorio De Sica or Fellini. You'd have a horrible mishmash, you know? But that was I thought, well, with Dino, it doesn't matter that it just cost 100 or 150 million. He was famous. He didn't care what it cost. And so it was arranged for me to go to New York, where his headquarters, and have a meeting with him. And I bought it back from Disney. I had nothing to say. I'm going to do this with Dino if he really decides he's going to do it. And all I had to do was give them back their money they invested in me. And I had no... They had nothing more to say about it. So I went to New York, and I thought, I don't know, he's an amazingly difficult man. Is this going to be a horrible thing for me to do? Is this going to be, I get in with this guy? And he was brilliant, yes. He was eccentric. But, you know, he had such a strong ego. You can imagine the big things he did. I thought, my God, maybe I'm just jumping from the frying pan into the fire. He doesn't care if it's good or bad. He just wants to make a big movie. And maybe he'll never agree with me and let me fix the story and the characters. So I remember the first meeting I had when I went with my agent. And we seemed to get along quite well. You know, I don't know. I reminded me, his son died in an airplane crash. And I reminded him of his son. And so he immediately, from the first day on, took a liking to me. And because he was so good to me and so such a powerful guy, yet he's trying to be reasonable. So I was shocked. I said, my God, this guy's going to be something I can work with. And at some point, something happened. And I said something to him. I said, well, Dino, look, deal's no good unless it's good for two people. I'll work with you, but I want clauses in it that say there are only five or six things you can't change. Everything else, you can do anything you want. But I want five or six things you can't change in the whole script. 90% you can change. It's 5 points. He heard this, and he said, I can change anything, but 5 or 6 points you're going to put down on paper. I said, yeah. Okay.
So this unusual, if not unique, deal that you made with Dino De Laurentiis that had story points embedded in them, what were some of the story points that he had to do or you could shut the movie down?
So I said, Dino, I'll make an agreement with you. There's only 6 things in the whole script you can't change. Not only can't write it differently, but 6 plot points you can't change. And everything else you can change. And he said, okay, I make that kind of a deal. The only 6 things? Yeah, what can be so bad about only 6 things in the whole movie? But turned out later, every time anybody tried, directors that came into it, trying to change any of those 6 things, I stopped them. And they would say, okay, well, I can't do it. Because they all wanted to make a movie that was totally different, but they couldn't without changing some or all of those 6 points. Mm-hmm. And the general first one was you had to go to Mars, because most people would say, hey, it's too expensive. Don't go to Mars, just talk about it. The ending of the whole movie has to be Mars gets air. And Dino didn't want it when I said that. He said, no, I want that. Because why? I know, like, when we talked about some of the points, because you can't see him getting air. I said, yes, you can, Dino, because on Mars, the air is pink and it's going to turn blue. Oh, my God, you're right. I never thought, okay, done. That's the ending. And so he was reasonable, but you had to say the right thing that would sell him.
Right.
It was very eccentric. Most people would say, well, I don't know if I want to go with the sky turning blue instead of pink. And then there was this creature that I had that I got the idea from when someone's born with a mutation? This could be like a semi-Siamese twin that never got birth. That's what I thought of in real life. Only the head and an arm is going to be there. And it wasn't anything to do with it. It was never in Phil Dick's story.
You're talking about the mysterious rebel leader on Mars named Quatto, who Arnold was trying to find to help him learn who he really was, but nobody knew where he could be found?
I said, we need that because everybody's got to not know who the leader is. They've never seen him. Why don't they ever see Quatto? Well, simple, because Quatto's behind his shirt. It's buttoned, and it looks like this other person's Quatto. But the real Quatto is this head that's growing out of his chest. That's why nobody's ever seen Quatto. And I said, I have to have that, no matter how insane it sounds. That's got to be one of the because the whole thing is, how come nobody knows what Quatto looks like? And when you finally opens his shirt, you know why nobody knew what Quatto looked like. So people didn't want to do that. They thought, oh, it's insane. You know, a semi-born Siamese twin? No, I think people are going to run from the movie. And so he said, I'll give you that. Okay, you want that.
I'm curious if you noticed that there's a correlation between the alien coming out of the chest and then this also other idea of this other character
right,
coming out of the chest.
Right. And I thought of that and I said, maybe I shouldn't do that. Maybe you should grow out of the back of his neck. And then Dan, my collaborator, said, no, you don't need that. I'll tell you why. The thing out of his chest is an incredible, grotesque menace. But the Quatto out of his growing there is a enlightenment. It's a guru who's bringing to him, open your mind. That was one of the key lines. And he took his little hands, he took hold of Arnold. And Arnold suddenly saw enlightenment. And he said, so that's a totally different feeling. It's what's our trademark, the craziness of our trademark. Yet it's not going to be confused with this thing that tore out of his chest. Then, before the meeting ended, we got to the big problem. I wanted my name above the title with his. Dino De Laurentiis and Ronald Shusett present. And I had learned years ago, when I was trying to make, my hero was Mike Todd, who did Around the World in 80 Days. And he always said one thing, I'll never work for anybody. I have to be the prime force. I have to be my name above the title with whoever I'm doing something with. I'll never just be producer or works for somebody else. And that influenced me because I read his biography when I was in high school and he was doing Around the World in 80 Days. I said, that's what I want to be. I want to be like his philosophy is. He's not going to be somebody who's for hire. It's always going to be, he's one of the original creators of it, even if he didn't read the material, write the material, which Todd didn't do, one of the original inspirations for the guiding force of it. And so I knew that I was never going to make a deal unless Dino would give me a credit with him. I didn't want it instead of him. And when we got to that part, well, Dino, I said, it has to be Dino Arenas presents Ronald Shusett production, or Dino Arenas and Ronald Shusett. No, I'm, what do you mean? I'm not giving you that. I'm Dino De Laurentiis. What are you saying to me? And I said, well, but this is the only thing I can live with, Dino. We have, no, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Dino's not giving you this. So this is about after an hour and a half of meeting. And I remember something great happened somehow. The agent was trying to stop this from blowing up. How many people have the wherewithal and the guts and the craziness to finance this thing, especially since Dino, Disney was backed out of it. They said, well, this is a pretty difficult guy to get along with, this guy, she said. And then my agent said, well, Ron, what are we going to do about this above the title? And he said, can anything be worked out, Dino? Yes, I changed my mind. Ron's going to get above the title. He has guts. He has balls. This man has balls. How dare him demand this? I like him. I give you above the title with me. Done.
So you won him over.
Yeah, I won him over, and it was the start of a great relationship. And the only time that I didn't make it with him was he ran thin on hard times, and he had to declare personal bankruptcy, not his company, but because he started to do these big, huge movies, and they pretty well broke him. But I forgot one important thing.
Go ahead.
I went to this is going to be really far out. I went to a spiritualist that was famous at then. I forgot her name, but Shirley MacLaine discovered her. She went to, you know how Shirley MacLaine was in spiritualism, ghosts. And there was a picture of Shirley MacLaine sitting at the table with this woman. I wish I could think of her name. Adele Tining. She was in San Diego. There was this ectoplasm sitting next to Shirley MacLaine. It was photographed. And so she made her famous that she really had, most of them were fake. So she was famous. I don't remember at what point, but it was before Total Recall became a reality. And I went to see her. Oh, and somebody said, go to her and ask her some of these questions because she can she'll contact Mike Todd in the spiritual world for you and see what he has to say. He was your idol. You tell him what's going on and see if he can tell you anything about what's going to happen. Is it going to happen? Is it going to be huge? So you go see this woman. And I went to see her. This is before I think the deal was done with Brandywine, the company that convinced Fox to back me up because they had a production deal and they had hits. Now, she has to be at least a mind reader because one of the things she asked me, she said, what do you have rapport with anybody that's dead, Ron? I said, yes, I do. She said, think of him, concentrate on him. So I did. And all of a sudden she said, his name is Mike Todd. I said, what? How could she know that? I didn't say anything to give it away. You're talking about Mike Todd, the great producer. He's coming. I hear him. He's connecting with you. A very strong connection. Oh, my God. I said, how could she? There's nothing. I was careful not to say anything that would give him that away. Is there anything you want to ask him? Yes. I want to ask him, what about this big budget sci-fi I'm trying to do that seems hopeless? Is it ever going to get made? And the table said, yes, it pounded down, yes. And I said, is it going to be a big hit? He said, huge. Table said, I mean, huge, huge, huge. I said, 100 million more. And it grossed 160 million. I swear to God. At that time, very few films did this kind of money. And so, of course, I was convinced I was talking to the spirit world. And it turned out, I guess I was. I said, what will I do, Mike? I said, you want to ask me? Yes, I'm out of money. I don't have any money to live on to keep up trying to get this made. I'm running out of living money. My mother's been paying my rent, giving food to me. What am I going to do? Todd said, keep pumping. That was me, Todd. Like, keep pumping. I said, well, how can I? I need money. The table gravitated towards this guy that brought me there. His name was Joe Nelson. He was a friend of my father's. He was not my contemporary, my father's contemporary. He took a liking to me, and he sort of guided me through. He always believed in me that I would become a big producer. And so the table floated right to him. And of course, they're saying she can manipulate her elbows. There's things she can do. Table went closer and closer. I said, I'll get money. I said, how will I get money? And the table moved to Joe and it backed him up against the wall. He could hardly talk. And it's, Joe will give me money. Yes, it was, yes, Joe will give. Joe has no money. He was struggling. He hadn't made a deal in 6 years. He was a real estate broker. Joe will make money. Yes. Yes. A week later, he made $100,000 and he supported me until Total Recall got made. I gave him a piece.
Tell us about all the different versions of the script. Like there were, 40 or 60 drafts of the script and how many directors? Tell us a little bit about that.
At least five or six. And I shot down everyone that would try and change it into a different movie. They all tried to change it. And they weren't used to anybody saying, no, you can't do anything you want. You have to do something similar to what he's got here. Mm-hmm. And no director wants to. They want to make their own movie. They don't care how much they change it.
Was Bruce Beresford, was he one of the Dino De Laurentiis directors?
Yes, and he wanted to change it all, like most of the directors did.
Right.
But he found out he couldn't. And so then he thought he was going to quit. He was driving Miss Daisy, his other huge hits. He wanted to do something radically different. And I thought of Hitchcock and Selznick, the first time they worked together. They both wanted to do, what was the story of the wife that died and he always was grieving for it, and it turned out he killed her. It was a Hitchcock's first big American movie. Maybe it was Rebecca. I don't know. And I remember the story about how Hitchcock and Selznick wanted to do it, but they both bought the rights. They both were bidding for the rights. And they had totally different visions. Selznick wanted to be more character-driven, and Hitchcock wanted to be more of a thriller. And finally, they reached agreement between them and won the Academy Award as Best Picture. So I said, if Hitchcock and Selznick can reach an agreement, I can reach an agreement with any director there is. And so I wrote a 17-page letter about why he was wrong and I was right. And all of a sudden, I thought, okay, he's going to quit too. And 2 days later, he said, you're right and I'm wrong. We're going to do it exactly the way you said. I got off the track. That was the most famous person. And he remained in the picture until Dino went broke and couldn't make the movie. And that's who he made the call and said, the movie's off. We built the sets twice. We built them in Italy. We built them in Australia. And now Dino's broke and he's fired everybody and the movie's off and we'll never make
it. How much money had been already put into
$3 million. No footage shot. $3 million involved in directors he had to pay off, development, other costs, interest, $3 million. Everybody said, well, the movie can never be made now. You owe $3 million before you even start shooting.
Which was the director who was set to do it and his mother died?
That was David Cronenberg.
Oh, tell us about David Cronenberg.
Well, he and I were arguing like crazy over how to do it. He was a horror meister too. He was terrific. He didn't care about making sense out of it. He just wanted, even if it was crazy and unbelievable, he wanted the horror moments. That's the only thing that he cared about. And I cared about, again, the story working. And yeah, I wanted the horror moments like Alien, but I couldn't do anything with the story. I couldn't make the story add up and make sense to the audience.
And it was about to move on, and that's when Dino went broke? Is that when that happened?
Yes. Dino needed to, he couldn't get distribution. He had all the financing, but he wasn't a distributor. So he needed to get Universal or 20th Century Fox. He needed somebody to say, I'll pay for it, but you got to distribute it. Costs, prints, and ads. And so they had to be on board with what we were shooting. And then we were trying to get a big enough star director to get distribution if Dino would finance it. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't because they all said it's too big of a risk without, you have to have a huge star director and a huge name actor also. And I get one, I get the actor, and then I lose the director. I get the director and I lose the actor. And that's why even though Dino had the money, he couldn't get distribution for it. So he couldn't proceed with a movie. And that's where Arnold stepped in.
This is a really odd thing, and most people don't know that, but wasn't Richard Dreyfuss the original star?
He was going to, yeah.
He came before, yeah. Talk about that.
Dreyfuss is a great actor. You know, he won an Oscar. He's fantastic. And I had made acquaintance with him along the way. I don't know how, at parties, or we became friends. And so he was early choice for Total Recall. He wasn't the bombastic superhero type. But he was a great actor. So I thought I could live with that. But somehow that didn't work out. I guess because he needed the director that he had confidence in. And I had him, but no director. So he quit for opposite reasons. We didn't have a disagreement of script because I couldn't get a huge enough director to make it worth. I can see any actor would want protection. I've got a director. The director could be weak or mediocre, and it wouldn't matter about the script and he and I being on accord. I think that was the point that Arnold saved the whole project. And I had only met Arnold once before, about 2 or 3 years earlier. And he loved the script because he always had good instincts about his material. And he wanted to do it immediately, but he wasn't big enough. At that time, I don't know, he'd not made Conan. He just made Conan. Everybody said, but that's the only thing he can do, Conan the Barbarian. He can't be a mass audience guy. And all of a sudden, when I had nobody but Arnold, he did back-to-back, The First Predator and Twins. And he became number one box office in the world. And everybody said, okay, you got Arnold to it. And that was just like a miracle. The only way I got it made was Arnold became hot enough. A couple of years earlier, he wasn't big enough. I couldn't get anybody else that had the vision. But he had the vision, and he became big enough, and he got it made. And it also got me Paul Verhoeven, because not only did I get the star, but Arnold uses his clout to call Verhoeven and say, I got this thing I want. Will you read it? Will you do it with me? He said, well, Paul said, I don't know. I'm close to giving a verbal commitment. I'm ready to sign a contract to do this other movie instead. Arnold said, no, we can't do later. It's either you want in or you want out. This is what I want to do. I'll give you the script. Okay, I said, I'll read it. And then Arnold told me later, about 2 days later, said, Verhoeven, I read the script. I only got halfway through when I realized I love it. I have to do this. I'm in. And so I don't need to finish it. It's the best American script I've ever read. And so between Arnold and Verhoeven, well, that's how the movie got made. I had the star and I had the director. Carolco put up the money. They had made these Rambo movies, and they were huge. And they were like independents, but they rose to fame. And their budgets cost $60-70 million. And that's what Total Recall was going to cost, $70 million. So they were much bigger gamblers in the studio. They knew if you have a good enough movie, it doesn't matter what it costs. And studios were saying, no, that's crazy. You know, you can't spend. How do you know the movie's going to be good? Just because you think it's going to be good. But they were built-in gamblers. I said, well, the thing is, we still owe Dino $3 million. No studio will put up. The studio doesn't have to put up. I just wrote a check. I said, why? Yeah, I just gave him $3 million. Now I own the rights. Now nobody's going to stop us. I took the $3 million bite the bullet, and we're making no matter what it costs. I can't believe it. I said, well, get ready to go on the plane. We're going to make this movie.
So Ron had his script, an ironclad contract that ensured him his 6 story points, which was completely outrageous in writer-producer deals. Nobody did that. He had a studio and a huge budget. He had a distributor, and he had his star.
What could possibly go wrong?
Funny you should ask. You'll just have to tune into episode 5, which we've titled The Schwarzenegger Effect, to find out.